Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Okay, the book of Revelation is it's complex. It's a tricky book. It's possibly one of the most complex books in the Bible, if not the most complex. In fact, so much so that many Christians just never really get their heads around it. They either assume that it's irrelevant and has nothing to teach them about their lives, or they just figure it's too complex that even if it has got anything relevant to say, there's no way we can figure out what on earth it is. So many Christians go their whole lives never really getting their heads around it. That, to be honest, has partly been my experience. I've always thought it's too deep for me to understand, and so I haven't even tried. And I've just figured that really I don't know what it's about very often. Hopefully I have more of a clue now. But I've gone many years of my life thinking I don't even know where to start in this kind of book. And I think that's many people's experience. But that seems slightly problematic to me, because the Bible itself says that all of it has something to tell us. So in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 to 17, it says, "All scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting, and training in righteousness, so that the servant of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work." So, no excuses. We can't just say that refers to everything apart from Revelation. I, as a Christian who takes the Bible seriously, have to trust that no matter how hard it is, Revelation has things to tell me that can aid and enhance my Christian life, my spiritual life. But I thought it would be helpful just at the beginning, partly for me to get a feel for where you're at, and partly because it's kind of amusing. Let's just have a chat about why people find Revelation difficult, if indeed you do find it difficult. I mean, am I the only one in the room that you're all fine with Revelation? Give me some ideas. What is it that you find difficult or complex or confusing about the book of Revelation? Very open to different interpretations, yeah. So many people have completely different perspectives on it. And yeah, mine's the right one, by the way.
Completely figurative.
Completely figurative. Okay.
Very figurative.
Sure.
Lots of numbers.
Lots of numbers. Yeah, what on earth do the numbers mean?
Symbolism.
Yeah. And it's not really, the problem is not so much that it is figurative and that there is symbolism, because we read stuff that's figurative and has symbolism all the time. It's just knowing what on earth it means, and it's so different to stuff we're used to reading and understanding. Yeah.
Big wild beasts doing crazy things.
Big wild beasts doing crazy. I thought you might like that, actually. But like, what on earth does it mean?
And how does that do for teaching and rebuking
and whatever? Yeah, good question. How do the beasts help us? Yeah. Is it figurative or not? Okay, are they literal beasts? Yeah. I mean, it's a serious question. Yeah.
Tim. More so than maybe any book in the New Testament, there's an awful lot of cultural references in it, like reference to Eve sits among the seven stars, the letters to the churches. It's really tricky to understand unless you know what it's talking about.
Sure.
So there's an awful lot of it that, whilst it's not necessarily figurative, it may well be literal. We don't know what it literally refers to because we don't sit within that culture.
Yep. Yep, good point. So it's not simply that there are metaphors that we can't understand and figurative sort of symbols and that sort of thing. It's even when it's being incredibly plain and straightforward about things, or it's still difficult to know what it's referring to. Actually, we were talking beforehand, loads of churches talk about the letters to Revelation. So if you're letters to the church, if you're familiar with the structure of the book, it opens with these letters to seven churches and instructing them about where they're going wrong or where they're going right and how they can be more effective churches. And loads of churches, when they preach on Revelation, they preach on those ones because they're good, and it's clearer, more easy to understand how those letters help us to grow in our Christian life. But then when it gets to the beasts, people are a bit like, I don't really know what to do with that. I'm going to skip the letters, not because I think they're irrelevant, obviously, but actually there's far more confusing stuff that we're going to get into over this series. But any other thoughts? Go for it. Okay,
And also reading the book of Daniel, you don't quite understand it that much. So it's one of those books that you read alongside the book of Daniel and try to make sense out of it.
Yes.
That's the way I approached it.
Yeah. Has anyone else had that kind of experience? People say, if you want to understand the book of Revelation, you've got to understand the book of Daniel. And then you go back and read the book of Daniel, and it's not much easier. what? as if there's some kind of book out there that makes sense of both of them that we're somehow missing. It's baffling. I was in a church that preached through Daniel, people really excited, only they preached chapters 1 to 6 and stopped, because there it gets crazy from 7 onwards. But yeah, okay, we're going to see there are lots of links to Daniel. Hopefully we'll be able to give you some tools that will help you to understand Daniel and Ezekiel and other books like it as well. But any other thoughts?
I was being prophetic about the future. Mm. But then also, I think it also has heavily influenced global politics.
Right.
The US talking about, we're going to reclaim the promised land, but we're going to back those people to come back. Well, actually, is that true?
Sure. So a couple of interesting things there. Is it about the future? If so, how is it relevant to us, and how has it been relevant to people for 2,000 years? So that's a big sort of question, hermeneutical question, so that's about how we interpret the passages, but also, yeah, political ramifications, and if this is a story that is going to be playing out, are we meant to be actively trying to make it happen? And many people would say yes, and therefore not we adopt the role of X character or X beast, but we see, if we imagine that this is a roadmap for future history, if I can speak like that, then what role does our politics, our decisions, our government play in that? Big questions. We may get to some of those as we go along. Okay, we've got to start somewhere, and it's a fairly baffling book. But what I hope we can do over these few weeks is have confidence that it's not as difficult as we might think. It is still complex. I don't want to make it sound incredibly easy, but I do believe that God put it in our Bible so that we could understand it with a bit of hard work. And so I want us to have tools to be able to interpret it ourselves. As such, we're not going to cover every verse, but I think today I want to give you some foundational principles for how to understand the book, how to approach it, and begin thinking about things like the numbers and the symbols and that sort of stuff, and whether it is all about the future or not. And then in the next few weeks, each week, we will take a chunk, and I think probably over those final 5 weeks, we will see 5 representative chunks of the whole, such that you will have ideas and clues for how you can go away and read the entire book and hopefully learn from it and understand it. Feel free to ask questions as we go. I can 100% guarantee I will not be able to answer every one of them. There are still bits of this book that I look at and I think, okay, I have a vague idea, but that is still confusing. But do feel free to ask. If I can't answer your question, that's fine. I will admit that, or I will find some way of fobbing you off. And I will go away and I'll think about it and it will play on my mind and I won't sleep for a week. So if you're happy having that on your conscience, then do ask questions and we're okay. And like, I'm happy for this to be a fun, interactive environment. Rows of chairs and notes are not meant to make it feel like a lecture. If you want to get up and walk around or ask questions or object or tear up your notes or whatever, that's fine. Let's make it fun, interactive, and so we can learn as best as possible. So let's think about some background information to the book. This is slightly dull, so we'll get through this quickly, but it helps to give us an understanding as to why the book was written in the first place. So the book was probably written around AD 95. It's not entirely clear, but that seems to be the general consensus of most modern scholars. And it would have been written during the latter part of the reign of the Roman Emperor Domitian, which we will see is relevant as we come a bit further into the book in later weeks. Some people place it earlier and say it was during the time of Nero. I think that's not likely for a number of reasons. Firstly, the book talks a lot about emperor worship, and it seems that Christians were being encouraged or forced, in some cases, to worship the emperor. And there's this thing, the imperial cult, and commentators talk about that a lot. Basically, emperors, Roman emperors, were setting themselves up as divine figures and demanding worship. And this obviously caused huge problems for the Christians, because as they refused to worship the emperor, they ended up facing political oppression. And this seems to be a major theme in the book. It seems to be something that was starting, but as John is looking into the future, he's getting a sense that it's going to become more and more and more and more of an issue. And so scholars tend to say that fits quite a lot with what we know about Domitian. And you may know nothing about Domitian, that's fine. We'll learn a bit more about him in future weeks. And if you don't care about that sort of thing, that's fine as well. there's loads of information and we don't need to know it all. But emperor worship is a major theme. Persecution of Christians is a major theme. In fact, arguably, the whole book is written to encourage Christians who are either facing persecution right there, they're in the midst of it, or they're kind of looking down the future of history and they're saying, if things carry on the way they're going at the moment, this is going to be a huge problem for us very soon. And so the book seems to be geared at helping Christians to be prepared for persecution and oppression. And again, scholars think this probably fits with the rule of Domitian in a slightly later date, because Nero did oppress Christians, but typically not in the sort of area of Asia Minor that this book was written to. And there's some interesting stuff in chapter 13, which we'll get to later, but we can ignore that for the moment. The condition of the churches. The book begins by writing to seven churches, and it seems that these churches have been going for a little while. So it talks about issues that have developed in the churches. Now, if the churches were brand new, we would expect that some of these issues wouldn't exist. So again, this is a hint that it was probably written quite late. In fact, Laodicea, where one of the churches is based, suffered an earthquake in AD 60 to 61, and yet the church is described as being rich, which implies that it's had at least a few years to kind of get back on its feet economically. So it's probably a later date than some would think. There's something called the Nero myth, which we will come to, which is in no way related to coffee, but it's the idea that the Emperor Nero, who died, would come back to life and would lead an army against the Romans. And this was a rumour and a myth that had started to develop, and there seemed to be hints about that in Revelation. Not that John is saying this is going to happen, but rather he's referencing this cultural myth. Now, that's unlikely to have generated during Nero's actual life. That would be a little bit strange. So again, it's probably an argument for a later date. And we'll get to that in Revelation 13. There is the Babylon metaphor. Does anyone know what a significant event that happened in AD 70?
The temple was destroyed.
The temple was destroyed. Okay. Who destroyed the temple?
The Romans.
The Romans. So post AD 70, when people wanted to refer to this climactic moment where the house of God, the temple, had been destroyed by the Romans, they started using the language of Babylon. So if you remember in the Old Testament, it was Babylon who destroyed the temple and carried the people off into exile. And so in the New Testament, in Revelation, in the time surrounding this, when people talked about Rome, very often they would give them the nickname Babylon, because Rome had acted like the Babylonians had in the Old Testament. Again, this is a hint for an older date for it of being written. And also early church fathers such as Irenaeus and Eusebius and Clement and Origen also seem to think it was quite a late book. That may seem a bit abstract, but some of those things are important as we go along. I think they highlight some of the major themes that the book deals with: emperor worship, persecution, and the relationship between the church and Babylon or Rome or the cities. It was written by John. Chapter 1, verse 4 tells us that. There is a good deal of debate over which John. We won't get into that now. But I think I'm happy that it was the Apostle John. In fact, Eusebius, an early Christian writer, tells us that of the 12 apostles, John was the only one not to have been martyred for his faith. But in his old age, he was sent into exile on the island of Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. And that's what we see at the very beginning of Revelation 1. In other words, because he refused to stop preaching the gospel and the fact that Jesus is Lord, that he alone is ruler, that he died on our behalf, that he rose again from the dead, because John refused to preach this message with all the implications it had for culture and political things, which we'll come on to, he was exiled to Patmos. He didn't die on Patmos. He was allowed to return to Ephesus, where he led the church before the end of his life. So, that's a bit of background about the date and the author. Any questions at that point? Otherwise, we'll get on to some more interesting stuff. Good. Okay, so what on earth is the book of Revelation? Well, in the first chapter, it tells us that essentially it's made up of three styles of writing. So chapter 1, verse 1 says it's an apocalypse. Verse 3 says it's a prophecy. And verse 4 says it's a letter. So Carson, Moo and Morris, who are theologians, not some weird-sounding folk band. Carson, Moo and Morris describe it as a prophecy cast in an apocalyptic mould and written down in letter form. In other words, it's a melding together of three distinct forms of writing. And one of the reasons that Revelation is so difficult to get our heads around is it's not really like anything else we know or read. It's a strange sort of mixture of genres. And it helps to know that from the beginning, because if you've ever come to pick up, well, I mean, I presume most of you have picked up a book at some stage, probably many books, but it helps to know what what kind of a book you are picking up. Are you picking up a novel or a phone directory or a whatever? Because there are different interpretive styles needed for each. And we're told here that this is a mixture of apocalyptic, prophecy, and letter. In fact, apocalyptic seems to be the big genre. Apocalypse is a style of writing that we just don't use today. I mean, I don't. I'm not aware that many people have used it beyond the second century. But it is a highly figurative way of writing things that speak about events that are going on, often political events. It uses a lot of metaphors, a lot of quite graphic pictures, quite difficult pictures, but it's something that the people would have been very familiar with reading. So we've already heard Daniel has elements of apocalyptic towards the end. Ezekiel has apocalyptic moments where you just feel like, what on earth are they talking about? But it's a style that people would have been familiar with then, even though we are not that familiar with now. And Revelation 1:1 says this. It opens with the revelation of Jesus Christ. And the first Greek word, the word translated there, revelation, is apocalypsis. And it means an unveiling, a pulling back of a curtain, a disclosure. So it's drawing back to reveal something that is already there. Apocalyptic is less about predicting the future and more about drawing back a curtain so that you can see behind it. I think very often what happens is when people come to the book of Revelation, they think, I don't recognize this. I'm not familiar with this style of writing. So what is it most like? And so they tend to think of maybe modern styles of narrative or horror film scripts, or, you know, just things that they're familiar with, stories, or they think, well, it's kind of a bit similar to prophecy. So therefore, they interpret it as prophecy. I want to propose that actually apocalyptic is not primarily prophetic about the future. It's more about drawing back a curtain so that you can see what's behind it. That's what the word actually means. So if you think about a theatre, you may well be watching what is going on the stage and you kind of look at it and you enjoy it and you experience it and you understand it. But if I were then to draw back the curtain or the flats at the side and you could see what was going on behind, you would not only get to therefore see what is happening on the stage, the experience, but why it's happening, what's making it happening, what's bringing the story to life. And apocalyptic writing is generally about that. It's saying, we are in this difficult world in which all sorts of things are happening, and if you want to understand them, you need to pull back the curtain and see what is going on behind the scenes. So actually, one of the major mistakes that people make about Revelation is thinking it's all about the future. And I would say, no, it's more about helping people to understand what they are going through by giving them a different perspective, namely God's perspective on the situation. And the reason why it is so complex, why there is so much difficult imagery, is because we are learning to see things not from a human perspective, but from God's perspective. And as John is writing down what he's seeing, he is just seeing these incredible, bizarre things and putting them down in the best language he can use to describe God's perspective on history's events. So, you may well ask, if the purpose is to bring clarity to how we understand the things that are happening around us, why is it so complex? It doesn't seem to me to bring much clarity. It seems to cause more confusion than anything else. I don't look around and think, oh, I don't understand this world. And I turn to the book of Revelation and think, oh, now I understand it far better because beast. You know, it seems a little bit puzzling. But one of the major features of apocalyptic is this. Because it's dealing with political themes very often, how Christians relate to this nation or when nations turn bad, how do Christians relate to that? Because it's dealing with these difficult issues, writers tend to use coded language to protect themselves. So it's language that other Christians would read and they'd be like, oh, I get that. It's kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, the beast is doing this. And you think, oh, okay, I know how to interpret that. But anyone who is looking on who is already hostile to the Christian faith would be like, I don't know, these Christians are weird. They've created this thing about beasts and I have no idea what it's talking about. The metaphors, the pictures, seem to be a way of encoding the message to protect the people who are going through persecution. And I'd suggest that unless we understand what the genre is about and how the symbols work within that genre, we'll have no idea of how to interpret the book. Stupid example, but on your notes, there are two pictures. Any thoughts what those pictures refer to? I'm sure people will recognise it. Do many people know? Stop ahead. Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Sure. Mine are blue and red, which makes it a little more obvious. Yet the elephant refers to the Republican Party in the States, the donkey to the Democratic Party. Now, if you were to pick up an American newspaper and you found an advert or a political satirical cartoon and it had an elephant and a donkey, I don't know, on the beach chatting around something or other, you could look at that and feel utterly puzzled. But if you understand the genre of American political satire, not that I particularly do, but you look at it with different eyes. Because you know that in that context, the elephant represents the Republican Party and the donkey represents the Democratic Party. And so if you've got a donkey and an elephant wandering through a woods chatting about something, you know it's probably some kind of coded cartoon about different political views on the environment or something like that. If you look at an advertising board and it's talking about an election and it's got an elephant and a donkey, if you don't know about the genre and how the symbols work, you could well be forgiven for thinking that Americans were deciding whether they wanted to be led by a donkey or an elephant. The point is that if we take things hyper-literally without understanding how the symbols are meant to be interpreted, we will get into all sorts of trouble. So we're going to think a little bit about how the symbols, how the code works in Revelation. It's different to American politics. There are no elephants in the book of Revelation, which is sad, but there we go. Yeah, go for it.
What are you saying about those Christians who kind of understand what John was writing about, so kind of seek to sort of that because it's a lot of to do with political stuff that's going on. I thought before you were saying that people were used to the apocalyptic kind of writing.
Yes. So, sorry, I'll try and remember to say the question as well so it'll go on the recording and so you can all hear. So the question was, what was the question? The question was, so I said that people would have been used to it and they would have understood it, but also
Christians would, it was kind of like a secretive way of writing for Christians to understand.
Sure, yeah.
Because it was, you know, sensitive stuff because it was to do with political things.
Great.
That were going on.
Yeah, sure, good question. Okay, so apocalyptic in the Old Testament, so books like Daniel and Ezekiel and that sort of thing, would have been a particular style that Jewish readers would have understood because it was referring to things from their scriptures and using metaphors they were used to. But the rest of the world at large wouldn't have understood those books. So they were written to believers. As the New Testament developed, obviously you get not only Jews, but Gentiles as well. And so maybe Gentiles found it a bit more difficult, but they would have had this history of apocalyptic that they could have looked back to and used to interpret it. But still, I don't think the world at large would have recognised exactly what they were talking about. So it was a way of being able to write to a community. And it wasn't fail-safe, obviously, but they had it in their history, I think. Any other questions at this point? Great. Oh, go for it. That's a good question. So did John think that it was going to be spread wider, or was he just writing to a particular audience thinking it would never go any further than that? I think a bit of both, probably. I think the letters to the seven churches are clearly directed at the churches. It's about them. And obviously we have lessons to learn from them, but I don't think that John was primarily thinking in 2,000 years there'll be some people gathering in London to think about this. And yeah, I think he was writing particularly to that audience. But I do think there's so much stuff in it about worldwide events that I think he must have been thinking far broader than simply these seven churches in Asia Minor. And particularly given that the book ends with the second coming and new creation, he must have thought there's a longevity to this book. I mean, it's going to be around until the end of time. So I think he probably did have an inclination of it going further. Whether he thought it would go in the canon or not, I don't really know. But he clearly thought it was God-inspired and may well have thought this is probably on par with Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Daniel. And so maybe he was aware of writing something that had that kind of, you know, gravity to it. Good question. Okay, well, let's look at a few major ways of interpreting the book, and then we'll come on to some of the symbols. Here are four major approaches that people have taken to interpreting the book of Revelation. The first is the futurist view. The futurist view tends to see everything from Revelation 4 to 22 as referring exclusively to a future time immediately preceding the end of history. So people read this book from the end of the letters onwards and they say this is all referring to what is going to happen just before the end of the world. And so they see it entirely future oriented. So, for example, some of you may have come across the Left Behind series of books. This very much takes this approach. It's all about, it's kind of a roadmap for how the world is going to be wrapped up at the end. I have a number of problems with this view. It's not really, I think it would be fair to say it is not academically respected as a view, although it is a view that many people sort of naturally come to, because it sort of feels kind of right. But there are some major problems with it. Namely, first of all, it takes as a major plank in its argument something called the rapture, which is the idea that Christians will escape the earth and the earth will be left to judgment for 7 years before the end. Actually, that's really not in the book of Revelation. I would argue it is only very loosely a biblical concept at all. And really, that idea runs completely counter to what the book of Revelation is trying to do. So the book of Revelation doesn't talk at all about Christians being taken out of the earth. It seems to be geared towards helping Christians to understand how to stand up against and persevere through and overcome struggles and oppression and persecution in their lives. So for that reason, I find it problematic. Secondly, if everything is just about the future and it's about what happens before the end of the world, how on earth is that relevant to John's writers, who he clearly had in mind and wanted to encourage? In fact, how on earth is it relevant to anyone for, well, up to now in history, who doesn't think we have yet reached the stage that this book is talking about? I think that is problematic. I think also the futurist view tends to not understand or apply any scholarship about what apocalyptic genre is meant to do. So it interprets things over literally, and it doesn't understand how the symbols work within the metaphor. Like I say, it's like seeing an American poster and thinking that there's an elephant running for president. It's that kind of feel. So those are some of my problems with the futurist view. The second view is the preterist view, and this is one that is very popular in academic circles, particularly with people who are very sceptical of the idea that God could look into the future. So the futurist view says it's all about the future, and God knows that and interprets it accordingly. The preterists, not all of them, but often, will be quite sceptical about the idea of prophecy in general. And they'll say, no, 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 it's not about looking into the future, or maybe it is, but only the very close future. And so preterists tend to see the whole book as being about events that were just about to happen. So some of them would say it's about the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. Again, I think that's problematic because I don't think it was written until AD 95. But that's a strong view. I think the preterist view has a number of problems as well, partly because it often just focuses so much on application to Israel, whereas John seems to be writing about things that happen all around the world. I think the preterist view is too narrow. I'll go over these quickly because essentially I want to build to the view I want to teach you. But if you do have questions, do feel free to chip in. The third view is the historicist view. And the historicist view sees Revelation as predicting major movements within history. So it is about the future. But the funny thing about this view is that wherever the commentator happens to stand in history, they will see what these things refer to completely differently. So one person will say, ah, okay, I see there's one prophecy that refers to Hitler here and the Second World War and all sorts of different things. But then actually, if you ask someone who lived maybe 20 or 30 years later with that little bit more history behind them, they would interpret the symbols in completely different light. This seems to be quite a subjective way of reading the book, and I don't think it's very helpful. It just seems a little bit strange. In fact, one of the odd quirks of the historicist view is it is basically only held in the Western world. And so Western theologians interpret the book of Revelation according to their experience and always forget that there's a whole load of the rest of the world that also has history. So again, I find that's a bit of a subjective view. The fourth view is the idealist view. And this view sees the book as a symbolic picture of the conflict between good and evil, or God and the devil, and thus it doesn't identify any of the symbols too closely to particular historical events. G.K. Beale, who's written the most enormous book on Revelation, it's fantastic, but incredibly hard and dense, he has a view which is called the redemptive historical form of modified idealism, which is just incredibly catchy. And basically his view, which I broadly agree with, though I think is ridiculously named, sees Revelation as symbolically depicting everything that happens within the church age. So by that I mean everything that has happened since the death, resurrection and ascension of Jesus up to the end of the world and the new creation. And so what John is doing here is he is using symbolic language that people would have understood to talk about how we interpret world events wherever we are in the church age, from the ascension of Jesus to the end of the world. And so I think what we shouldn't be doing is necessarily looking at the text and saying, ah, now what does that picture refer to? What is the historical event that that is referring to? More it's a case that when we look around the world, we see things going on, we can say, well, that looks a little bit like what I've read in Revelation, and therefore we can draw the lessons, learn from the lessons, and apply them accordingly. So it is kind of prophetic in the sense that it's looking to the future, and actually there are some key passages which are definitely about the future. So the second coming, for example, that's not something that recurs throughout history. There's one second coming, one new creation. But everything in between is generally talking a bit more about how to understand what is going on in the world in this time from the ascension of Jesus to his second coming. Now, that may seem a bit abstract. Probably it will become a bit more clear when we go through and we actually start looking at the text. But any thoughts on that or any of the other interpretive approaches? You're happy. I've won you over. You'll agree with me. That's wonderful. Okay, I mean, as I say, it probably won't really make a lot of sense until we get into the texts themselves and we start seeing, so particularly the different judgments, the seals and the bowls and the trumpets. And the futurist view would very often say, no, you have these seven and then the next seven and the next seven, and my view will be a little bit different. And when we get into those texts, I think maybe it will raise some more questions. But broadly speaking, I'm going to argue the book of Revelation has relevance to any person in any part of church history from the ascension of Jesus to the end. And there will be times when persecution is more strong and things feel more like the book of Revelation than at other times. But we should be able to draw encouragement and strength from it wherever we find ourselves in the church age. Let's look at some of the symbols. In fact, we'll start with the numbers. There are a lot of numbers in the book of Revelation. And actually, the fact that there are a lot of numbers, I think, is a clue that they're not meant to be taken literally. Because it's not like God just decided, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have this judgment and this judgment and this judgment. And then he looked at them all and he thought, oh, you know what? They happen to fall into four sets of seven. That's lucky. I think it's more likely that the fours and the sevens and the sixes and the thousands and all those sorts of things actually mean something. So that the numbers are meant to convey a kind of particular meaning and perspective. So let's just look at a few of them. Seven is a number that appears regularly in the book of Revelation. Seven is the number of completeness in Scripture. So creation was completed in 7 days. The Old Testament regularly uses seven in that way. I think I've given you some references. Do go and check those so I'm not just throwing in biblical texts and trying to convince you. Check them out, see what you think. But this seems to be a way that the Old Testament regularly uses the number of seven. It refers to completeness, fullness. Actually, this went wider than just the Jews and the Christians as well. And in the ancient world, various Roman rulers would use the number seven. So Hadrian and Commodus had coins minted with their image and seven stars, which represented the completeness, the fulfillment, the fullness of their rule. Four is also the number of completeness, which is slightly confusing, but it has a slightly different feel to it. So four typically refers to completeness and worldwideness, if I can just make up a word there. So we talk about the four corners of the earth. We read a little bit later, Revelation 7, it talks about the four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back four winds. And clearly what's happening here is John is talking about a complete worldwide thing that is happening. And very often when we come across the number four, that's what it means. In fact, the phrase every tribe, tongue, people and nation is fourfold. It's talking about four things. And when you look at those, it's saying the complete humanity, all of mankind. That's what four means. 12 also, confusingly, represents completeness. But again, there's a slightly different angle. It includes the idea of diversity. So, for example, there are 12 months in a year, two sets of 12 hours in a day, as cultural examples, but crucially, there are 12 tribes of Israel in the Old Testament and 12 apostles in the New Testament. So it's kind of, if you summarize the whole, the complete people of God, within that completion there is diversity. And that's what the number 12 typically refers to. We'll see that as we go through. 10 also refers to completeness, which again is slightly annoying. But, well, perhaps it's a little less clear why 10 does. There are 10 commandments in the Old Testament, so that seems to have been a major reason. If you look through the Old Testament, you'll find many examples of 10 being a good or a full or a round number. And it seems to be used in a similar sort of way in Revelation. In Daniel, he and his friends were tested for 10 days. They weren't eating the king's food for 10 days, and they emerged 10 times more wise than those around. And again, it seems that 10 is just used as a sort of general good number. You know, when you need a good, strong number, 10 is the one they choose. And interestingly, similarly, in Revelation 2:10, we're told that believers will be tested for 10 days but emerge victorious. That seems to be a little hint to Daniel. And then sometimes, just to make things even more confusing, these numbers are combined and timed against each other and added together to create more and more levels of metaphor. Now, my maths is horrendous, so I don't really kind of look at the Bible and think, oh, I'm pretty sure that's the seventh time I've read that phrase and it's in a set of four. And I don't think like that. Some things it's just not helpful knowing. So, for example, it's helpful, but I'm not expecting anyone to spot it. I wouldn't spot it. The phrase the lamb is used 28 times, which is 7 times 4 times, which seems to be talking about the completeness of his rule and also the worldwideness of his rule. And what John has done is combine two powerful numbers together to make a really powerful statement that says Jesus' rule is complete and it's worldwide. Again, I don't expect that you will read through and go, oh, that's the 28th time I've read Lamb in this book. But those kind of insights are interesting. There are all sorts of others as well, which don't really matter. But 1,000 is another number that is used again and again and again. So very often they will take a number like 12 and add 1,000 on at the end. And the reason here, I mean, it's quite straightforward. It's just to make it bigger, basically. It's not that complex. I don't think we're meant to literally think when it talks about 12,000 people in this tribe, 12,000 people in this tribe, that literally there was a cutoff point and they said, you're 12,001. I think it's talking about the completeness of the people of God, the diversity of the people of God. But actually, if they just said, well, there are 12 people in this tribe and 12 people in this tribe, it would feel a bit rubbish. So they locked the number 1,000 on at the end to make you know that it's complete and it's big. So this is just another way that numbers are used symbolically. Sometimes they're added together or multiplied. So there are 4 times 7 sets of judgments, which tells us that God's judgments will be complete, 7, but also worldwide. The merchants of the earth in chapter 18 have 28 items with them. I have no idea who counts these things. But again, it's 7 times 4, indicating that the things they are bringing are coming from all around the world. These are just nice little things that you spot every now and then. 12 is squared to create the number 144, which is the fullness of the diversity of the people of God. And then, because 144 people doesn't sound that great, they put 1,000 on at the end, so they talk about the 144,000. And again, it's kind of metaphorical, pictorial ways of making you think, wow, God's end time people is huge, it's also incredibly diverse and full, i.e. there aren't people missing from it. So, these are a few ways that the numbers are used. Interestingly as well, there is no number that is especially assigned to the devil or to evil characters, except in parody of good numbers. So, for example, we read about the Trinity, and so the number three comes up every now and then. And obviously in the Trinity, you've got the Father, the Son, the Spirit, or in Revelation, it's often the Father, the Lamb, and the Spirit. And we find when we read later on that there is another Trinity at work with the prophet, the beast, and the Antichrist. And again, it's a parody of what is good about God. So seven seems to be a number that is talking about completion, but it's also often applied to God. And when we get to 666, the number of the devil, the point seems to be that at every point the devil falls short of what God is. So he is one number below. So again, there are these kind of things going on, and we'll spot some of them as we go through. Any questions on the numbers? Has my maths gone horribly wrong at some point? Go for it.
A really specific question. Mm. I
will tell you, my answer in this series will never be go on Google, because if you Google anything on Revelation, you will find bizarre stuff. So.
Well, this is bizarre, specifically in relation to number 10. Mm. So what are the references in Revelation about the number 10? It's something to do with the government at the end of the world, and it's 10 nations, and that's linked to, they've got to have countries leaving the EU soon, so it comes down. What are the sorts of references related to that in Revelation that people get that linked to 10?
Yeah, we'll come to that a little bit in week 4, I think, when we get to chapters 13 and 14, and there are beasts with seven heads, and on each head is 10 horns, and all these sorts of things. I mean, I don't think that they are referring to 10 nations. Like, if we get rid of 2 from the EU, then the world's going to end. I don't think it's that kind of thing going on. 10 is completion, and it's a strong number. So often when it's 10 horns, it's referring to, it's not a weak thing. The power that this beast has is strong. It's a round number. It's not like a couple of horns. It's talking about the power and strength behind it. We'll come to that a bit more clearly as we go through. But yeah, I wouldn't.
So in a nutshell, you're talking about characteristics more.
Yeah.
In terms of
yeah, absolutely. And I would say, if it was about the EU, how would that encourage John's readers who are going through horrendous times and being persecuted? I know everything's difficult at the moment. Let me tell you about what's going to happen in thousands of years' time. I just don't think that's what he's doing. So. But we'll come to that as we go. Okay, Old Testament allusions are often very important to pick up on. So actually there are bizarre pictures here and there and everywhere. But as Christians, we believe that the Bible holds together because it has a singular author. God inspired it all. And therefore, I think it is reasonable that things we read in the final book should be able to be influenced, or we should be able to understand them by looking back at how these pictures are used in earlier books. And so one of the key things that I'm doing as I'm going through and I'm finding these difficult things is I'm looking and I'm saying, has that picture been used anywhere else? And how can its other usage tell me how to use it and interpret it here and now? So, for example, there are all sorts of things about lampstands and mountains and the sea and trumpets and incense and thrones and cities like Babylon. And these should call to mind Old Testament ideas. And then if we go back and look at how they're used in the Old Testament, they give us clues and keys for interpreting them in Revelation. We'll look at some of these as we go along. There are also general metaphorical images. So things that are maybe not strongly biblically based, they just, in general common sense and common usage, mean particular things. So, for example, I mean, what do you think a throne represents? A king. So rulership and authority. Maybe a place where a king rules from. What do you think a crown might refer to?
A king.
A king, yes. Again, kind of rulership, authority, those sorts of things. How about a mountain?
Strength.
Sorry? Strength. Strength, yep. Closeness to God, in the sense of going up the mountain to be closer.
So, like, throughout the Old Testament and a lot of the myths at that time, I think they had that idea of the mountains were where you meet with the heavenly beings.
Yep, absolutely.
Challenges?
Yep, that may be part of it. Sorry? Yes, that's a good one. Also, the idea, I think, of in the mountains was very often the place where battlements were built. It was a strong place, and there seems to be something of that as well. So rule, strength, closeness to God. And we need to look at the context to understand if we're getting it right and which one of those answers we apply. But you see, it's not actually that difficult when you stop and you think about it. Some of them are common sense. It's when they all come together it's difficult. How about horns? By which I don't mean trumpets, I mean horns. Strength, yep. Yep. Strength of arms, did you say? Yeah, weapons. Okay, yep. So it's slightly more aggressive than a crown, isn't it? So a crown speaks of authority, but it's a measured sort of rule. Horns are... it feels a bit more like you're gearing up for battle. Okay, great. These kind of things... it's not that hard when you think about it, but when they come together, it's a little more tricky. I mean, let's just look at one passage in particular. Revelation 19, verses 14 to 15, speak about Jesus, and it says this: the armies of heaven, arrayed in fine linen, white and pure, were following him on white horses. And then from Jesus' mouth comes a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. That seems a little bit bizarre, particularly if you think it's very literal. But actually, if you think about it, each of the elements is relatively straightforward. So what do you think the linen that people are wearing refers to? And clothes, obviously. They weren't riding naked on horses. But it's fine linen. What does that mean?
Wealth.
Wealth, yep. Dignity, that kind of thing. What does the idea of being clothed in something tend to refer to in the Old Testament?
The righteousness of the saints.
Righteousness.
There you go.
I mean, I kind of deliberately picked out a couple of verses there, but I mean, that highlights a key point. Look at what it says in the other verses. And sometimes John helps you out and he goes, by the way, in case you're pretty dumb, this means this. And he's pretty oblique about it. Yeah, it's to do with righteousness. So the idea of the things being white and pure, as opposed to blood spattered, that's another thing about purity. They're following him on the horses. What do horses represent? Battle, yep. And again, sort of strength. They're not walking into war. They're riding into war.
Kind of regal as well.
Kind of regal, yep. What do the colour of the horses represent? The horses are white?
Purity.
Okay, so we're looking at this army and we're thinking, okay, whose side are they on? Clearly, everything about them is screaming purity. They're on God's side. The sword comes out of his mouth. What do swords represent?
Truth.
The truth. Yeah, I mean, a bit more literally than that. Death, judgment, war, punishment, those sorts of things. The sword comes out of his mouth. What do mouths represent? Or rather, what do mouths do? They speak. Okay, so combine the sword and the mouth, and it seems to be somehow Jesus speaking in a way that brings judgment. Okay, so you're seeing how the metaphor is coming together. It's sharp and effective. And it will strike the nations. How big a sword would it have to be to strike the nations? It's coming out of his mouth. It's clearly talking metaphorically here about some kind of judgment that will come. Jesus will declare something and no one will be able to escape it. He will declare what is true and it will have a judging effect. It's sharp, it's effective, no one will be able to escape it. So you see how just thinking about every little bit and putting it together, it's not actually as complex as... or as daunting, maybe, as you might think at first.
Is that linked to the armour of God as well? Like the sword and the spirit?
Yeah. Possibly, possibly. And one of the tricky things is knowing where to stop, because metaphors are used multiple different ways in different times, and you've got to look at the context to think, is this a happy passage or a negative passage? And that might help you to understand whether it's talking about something judgment-y or blessing-y. I'm just making up words all over the place today, just like John. So. Yeah, the likelihood is that I don't know if John would have read other texts, only would have read the ones he wrote, but I don't know if he would have been familiar or expected his readers to be familiar with the other New Testament texts at this point. I think probably so, they would have known some of them, but I imagine that he's drawing mainly from Old Testament literature. But of course it's not an either or, because the other New Testament writers are doing the same sort of thing, so in theory there is kind of connection. But, yeah, ideally I'd be looking to... Yeah. And also an important thing is not only look at how the thing is used in the Old Testament, but what John does to it, because there are some things that we'll see in the next passage where he takes something that everyone knows and everyone is used to, and they read it and they go, oh, I immediately know that represents X, Y, or Z, and then John just turns it on its head in the light of Jesus. In fact, Jesus did that all the time with parables, and people are like, oh, I know where you're going with this, and suddenly he just, like, sting in the tail, totally changes it, and you think, whoa, I now see things in a new light. And John does that as well sometimes as well, so you've got to watch what he does, particularly when he brings images together, and we'll see that next week. Okay, let's look at Revelation 1:9-20. You've got notes, and they will give you some clues about things, but it may be that actually you don't want to look at the notes right now. I don't know about you, but I find it helpful sometimes not just to read what someone else has said, but think through the process myself. So it may be that you don't want to look at the notes, and we'll figure out the passage together. And hopefully it will be relatively straightforward. But the book opens with the revelation of or about Jesus Christ, which tells us immediately that the content and the focus of the book is not primarily beasts and nations and the EU and nuclear fallout and those sorts of things. It's primarily about Jesus. The book is about Jesus and his interaction with the world. And I think that's just something that helps us to stay on course. If we ever feel like we're reading a passage and we're coming out with all sorts of bizarre things, but we haven't thought about what it tells us about Jesus, then maybe we're missing what John is trying to tell us. So, yeah, go for it.
Why, looking at the bit that comes next,
yep,
about that idea of about, it seems to suggest that it's not so much about Jesus as a revelation that God gave to Jesus to explain this, because it says, which God gave him to show the servants what must take their place.
Yep,
so does that imply that it's not necessarily always about Jesus in that sense of Jesus is going to be a symbol in every bit of this passage?
Oh, sure,
it's
sure.
A story about him explaining this is the way things are working.
I think.
Or is that because of all should be translated as about?
No, I think it's a bit of both. I think that's a fair point. I think it's both a revelation that Jesus gives, but it's also primarily a revelation about him. And that doesn't mean that Jesus is in every verse, like hiding behind the beast here. But everything points to him, and it's about his interaction with the world. In fact, I think arguably chapter 5 is the hinge of the entire book, and it's all about worship of Jesus and what he has achieved. And out of that, you understand all the events of history. So while he's not referenced in every verse, I think it's all about the interaction of the world with him and that sort of thing. Would someone read out Revelation 1:9-20? Okay, fantastic. So as we've already seen, John was on Patmos, which is a small island about 35 miles off the southwest coast of Turkey. He was in exile for his preaching of the gospel. And we're told in verse 10 it was the Lord's Day, which by this time would have come to refer to Sunday. So obviously in the Old Testament, Jews worshipped God on a Saturday. Christians changed that in honour of the resurrection of Jesus, which would have happened on the Sunday. And so the word the Lord's Day had started to refer to Sunday. So he seems to be worshipping on a Sunday. But also there's an extra kind of edge to it, because in the Roman Empire, people would celebrate once a month the Emperor's Day. And this was the day which was dedicated to worshipping the Emperor. And so in calling something the Lord's Day as opposed to the Emperor's Day, it seems to be a kind of a political statement that we are worshipping not a man, but Jesus. We're not worshipping the Emperor primarily, we're worshipping Jesus who was raised from the dead. And that seems to be what John is saying. In the spirit means that he had a particular prophetic experience where God revealed things to him. It's a phrase that is used by the Old Testament prophets like Ezekiel. So John seems to be seeing himself as being in that kind of mold, a prophetic figure. A voice like a trumpet is reminiscent of Moses' experience on Sinai in Exodus 19. So already we get this sense that John is saying, I had an experience that is similar to that of Ezekiel, but also similar to that of Moses. And he seems to be taking some of the key moments in Christian and Jewish history and saying, another one is here. This is a key moment. And we'll see that there is loads of Moses and Ezekiel imagery that comes through the rest of the book. The voice tells him to write to the seven churches. We're not going to look at those letters, but I'd encourage you to look at them. And they are easier to understand than some of the other stuff we're going to look at. But again, if you have questions, do feel free to ask on other weeks. Verse 12, John says he turned to see the voice, which is slightly odd. I don't tend to look at voices. Now, on one level, it might simply mean he heard a voice and he turned to see the owner of the voice. I think that's probably quite likely. But also there's something going on here which I think is interesting. And there are a few times throughout the book where John turns expecting to see something. And when he sees it, it's not what he expected. And so maybe he's doing something here to prepare us for that. We'll see one of those examples next week. Okay, seven lampstands. What do the seven lampstands refer to? Seven churches. How did you know that? Because it says it. Brilliant. Okay. I mean, straightforward. We can agonize over what the lampstands mean, but actually John is nice to us on this occasion, and he tells us what the lampstands mean. He's just listed seven churches, so that's a clue. In verse 20, he tells us explicitly that's what he means. But the old idea of the lampstand has a rich Old Testament background. So there were lampstands in the tabernacle and in the temple, which emanated light, which represent God's presence. Actually, the Old Testament... Yeah, in the tabernacle, the lampstands were carved in such a way as to resemble trees, which seemed to be a hint back to Eden again, saying in Eden there was the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and that's been carried through into the tabernacle and then the temple, and we'll also see in the final week that that's there in the new creation as well, which is interesting. But lampstands represented God's presence in the place where he dwells. So here, the fact that churches are referred to as lampstands indicates that churches are primarily places where God dwells. Verses 13 to 15. Jesus is called one like a son of man. Now, this phrase means a number of things. On one level, it simply means human. So you know in the Narnia books where the fawn says, daughter of Eve and son of Adam. And it just means male and female, basically, other way around, was it? But male and female, it's just kind of language for you're humans. And in one sense, son of man simply means that as well. So in Psalm 8:4, it says, what is man that you are mindful of him and the son of man that you care for him? I.e., what are any generations of humanity that God would care for you? It simply means man. But also there is a slightly more technical meaning to it. Oh, Ezekiel is called son of man 39 times in his book. And again, it just sort of means a human, but maybe a human who's been chosen for a particular task. And in the book of Daniel, it is a key phrase that is used, particularly in chapter 7, where we get this picture of the Ancient of Days sitting in a courtroom scene and one like a son of man approaches him. And we don't have time to look at it now, but if you were to look at it, you'd see that there are a number of beasts attacking this one like a son of man and all sorts of imagery which sounds incredibly similar to what we see in Revelation. And it seems to be saying that there is this nation, Israel, who is this one like a son of man, who is approaching God and God judges in their favor, vindicates Israel against their oppressors. But Jesus took that phrase, son of man, for himself. And so if you read through the Gospels again and again and again, we don't find that he refers to himself often as the Son of God. He calls himself the Son of Man. And what he seems to be saying is this. I, understanding Daniel and the prophecies there, see myself as the one perfect representative of Israel. So it's like Jesus was taking on the role of the people of God. He was the true person of God. And what John seems to be doing here is saying, remember Daniel, remember that courtroom scene where you've got beasts attacking this pure person and in the end he wins out and God gives him favour. Well, that person I saw in my vision. And he seems to be drawing our minds back to that to set us up for the idea that this is going to be a book ultimately about the victory of Jesus. I think actually if you were to summarise Revelation in two words, I would say Jesus wins. That's the way it goes. Jesus wins. And there will be hardships along the way. There will be battles, there will be oppression, there will be difficult times. People will struggle with their faith, but Jesus wins. And right from the beginning, John wants you to know whatever you are going through, he is solid, he is firm, he always has been. He is the one with the strength. Jesus wins. Which is quite a lot to say with only a couple of words. One like a son of man. It just calls to mind all these ideas. And the description that follows is really similar to Daniel chapter 10. Verses 5 to 6. In fact, why don't someone read those verses? Daniel 10, verses 5 to 6. Anyone got that?
Yeah. I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen, with a belt of fine gold, but up hats around his waist. His body was like topaz, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burning bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude.
Great. Do you recognise some of those phrases, some of that description? John seems to be drawing on that in his depiction of Jesus. Again, trying to draw your mind back to Daniel. It's also striking that many of the things that are described there are similar to the kind of things a priest would have worn. So John seems to be saying that Jesus is like a priest and he's like the one like a son of man in Daniel. Jesus is depicted as the one who is with and who cares for his churches. So one of the roles of the priest in the temple will be to tend to the lampstands. They would check the wicks were okay, there was enough oil, they would keep the lamps alight, and Jesus seems to be doing that here with his churches. So John sees number of lampstands, Jesus walking amongst him, them, dressed like a priest, and his message is this. Churches, Jesus is amongst you. Jesus is caring for you. He has your best interests at heart. Let's look at some of the different bits and pieces. Eyes like fire. What do eyes represent? Sight. Sight. Eyes represent the ability to see. Okay, so... Sorry? The ability to prophesy. In the sense of vision, yeah. In the sense of being able to see particular things, yes. What does fire represent? Purifying and judgment, did we say? Okay, I think it's probably both of those things together. So if you combine the idea with eyes and the idea of fire, it's something about he's able to see, and when he sees, he can either purify or judge. So he's walking amongst these churches, and he is seeing everything that is going on in these churches, and to some things he is seeing, that's not good, and there's a sense of judgment. But to other things, he's looking at it and he's saying, okay, this is good. There's faith there. We can purify that. We can work with that. And that's what we find in the letters to the churches. Jesus sees particular things about their spiritual state and he tells them off for particular things, but he encourages them for others. He has white hair. That doesn't represent old age. What does that represent? Purity. What's striking is actually in Daniel 7 verse 9, the description of the hair like white wool is used not of the one like the Son of Man, but the Ancient of Days, who's God. So John seems rather strangely to be taking different metaphors and piecing them together, perhaps hinting that if you remember Daniel, you've got one guy and then you've got God. Actually, he's combining them together here, saying that Jesus is more than a priest. He is, in a sense, God as well. Which is quite a bold and radical thing to say. He has feet or legs like bronze refined by fire. What are feet and legs about? Walking and standing, those kind of things. Bronze refined by fire. What's, if something's refined, what's happened to it? Been purified. So there's no impurity in bronze refined by fire. So combine the images. Jesus is walking among the churches. And as he does so, he's completely pure. There's a sense of Jesus' pure presence in amongst his churches. Yeah, possibly. In Daniel, there's an image, a vision of this statue, and there are various different parts of it. Feet of clay, bronze, all sorts of bits. Yes, maybe, but I don't know. I could happily give that some thought and read on it. But yeah, that may be there as well. But I think at a basic level, it's talking about purity as well in the way that Jesus walks amongst his churches. He has a voice like the roar of many waters. Obviously, that's loud. And again, this is similar to the picture in Daniel chapter 10. So it's a strong graphic picture of what Jesus is like. He holds seven stars in his right hand. The right hand in the Old Testament symbolizes power and authority. So we're told that people sit at the right hand of a ruler, and that represents authority, a privileged position. Stars, we're told in verse 20, represent the angels of the seven churches. The sword comes from his mouth, which represents his authority to speak in judgment. His face is shining like the sun, which again is similar to Daniel. It talks about glory. But also, there was one key event in Jesus' ministry that John was at that many of the other disciples weren't, and that was the Transfiguration, where Jesus is displayed in some of his glory, and we're told he was shining. And if John, having seen that one-off experience, then greets Jesus again and sees his face shining like the sun, it must have been quite an awe-inspiring experience for him. There, on the Mount of Transfiguration, he saw a little bit of Jesus' glory. Now, he sees him fully glorified, shining like the sun. John's reaction is to fall to the ground as if dead, which is a common reaction of people coming into the presence of God in the Old Testament. It means you are overawed by his beauty and his majesty and his power and splendor. And then it uses the phrase the first and the last, which is a title used of God again and again in the Old Testament, meaning that he is sovereign over all time and all history. There's nothing before the first and nothing after the last. So God is sovereign over everything. And the fact that that is said alone of God in the Old Testament and is now said of Jesus in the New Testament hints at the fact that something significant has happened in the person and work and life and death and resurrection of Jesus. That means that now what is said about God can be said about him. We are dealing not with just a priest par excellence, we're dealing with God himself. And he has authority over death, having defeated it. So because of that, John is told not to fear. Do you see how actually when you think about it piece by piece by piece, it's a little less complex than you might at first think? Now, this is one of the easier passages, and there are more complex things as we go through. But just by thinking, how is this phrase used in the Old Testament? What does this number mean? What does this limb, which we still have today, and we know how they work, but what does this represent? You're able to slowly piece together this picture of Jesus. So what application do we draw from it? Well, I think right from the get-go, we know that Jesus is amongst his churches. And so whatever you are going through right now, you can know that Jesus is with you. That he sees everything in your life. Even the things you think you are keeping hidden, he sees them. That he is for you. There is a sense in which he comes to correct, but there's also a sense in which he comes to purify and to strengthen and to protect. Like a priest tending the wicks of the lampstands, Jesus wants to shape us as a church. He wants to keep us alight as a church. He wants to be working in our life. And John's response is simple. He just falls down and he worships him. And I guess, I mean, we're just going to close now. But my feeling is if we go through 6 weeks of reading the book of Revelation and we come out the other end feeling like we know more stuff, but we don't feel more in love with Jesus, then we've missed the point. Because right here in chapter 1, when John encounters him, he realizes he's more than a man, more than a priest. This is God himself. And since this book is a revelation about Jesus, about what he has done, about his victory and his power in our lives, I would hate for us to read and study this book and come away with anything less than a sense that he is incredible. And so sometimes it would be great, I think, for us to stop and pray and worship, and so we don't get entirely academic and just think of things at this particular level. I want this book to encourage us. We're going to see as we go on. Next week, we're going to marvel at the wonder of the gospel. And we're going to read chapters 4 and 5, which are the most beautiful passages in Scripture to my mind. And they talk about what Jesus has done and achieved at the cross and at his resurrection. And that should move us to worship. We're going to see things about the bowls and the judgments and the trumpets and the seals. And that could be daunting. But I believe that as we look at them, keeping Jesus in mind, what's this about? How does Jesus win victory? We will find they're actually encouraging messages. And they have a lot to tell us about God's plan for the world and his love for people and his desire to draw them to himself. We're going to look at complex stuff about beasts and prostitutes and odd graphic imagery. But as we look at that chapter, I think we're going to learn that God protects his people, that he loves his people, and that should be the most hope-giving chapter. And of course, we're going to come to the end to his plan for renewing all of creation. And I doubt many of us will fall down as if dead, but I do hope that many of us will feel like we encounter God in a new way and are strengthened by him for whatever is going on in our lives.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.